very glad to be back here. The most enduring image I've had of you since I was here in February is one of you sitting out on the patio, watching the sunset on the Pacific, drinking gin and tonics, trading tenses on the napkins, perhaps. But I look at the web page and see you're actually doing quite a lot of work, all these papers. Perhaps that's because of the cold weather, I don't know. Anyway, thank you for inviting me back. I'm going to talk about two things to do with ABN from the observational perspective. Firstly, in active spirals, you have a stellar disk, a normal stellar disk of the galaxy, and you have presumably a nuclear accretion disk, and it's of interest to ask what's the relative orientations of these two disks. And the second thing I'm going to talk about is the nature of the radio-loud, radio-quiet dichotomy in AGN, again, from the observational perspective. If you want to measure the direction of an accretion disk in an AGN, you have to find some probe of its polar axis. There are one or two ways of doing this, but the only way that can be applied to a large sample of objects is to measure look at the radio jets in these objects. And that's what I'm going to be using as a probe of the, presumably the polar axis of the accretion disk. These are, I want to emphasize, radio quiet objects in the Seyfert galaxies. You still see in the literature sometimes statements that radio quiet objects don't have jets. They don't have radio emission even. This is not true. The characteristic structure is this double or triple radial structure that you see here in some recent work from the using the VLA. And these jets can be very highly collimated, as you can see from a map like this, which is again a Seyfert galaxy, a radio-quiet object, NGC4151. Recently mapped with the VLBA, where we can now get really good resolution on these 100 parsec scale radio structures. I see the collimation really is very good. So it's really a myth to say the collimation of radio quiet objects is poor or weak, as is sometimes said. It's not a radio quiet object. And again, you see a really very nice radio jet when you can actually get the resolution to see what's going on. If anyone's bothered about the radio loud, radio quiet distinct, I'll talk about that, define that more closely later on. So we're going to use this direction of this axis to probe of the accretion disk axis. Of course, what we can measure is just the projection of the accretion disk axis on the sky and the major axis of the stellar disk. And we're going to talk about the difference between this axis and the galaxy's major axis, which henceforth will be called delta.
And you can talk about whether it gets the one side, you see it gets the one side, it's two sided.
I wasn't, but I think they're two sided.
Do you think they're relatively on the smaller scale?
This is the issue that I shall return to at the end. And that's actually, I think, the crucial issue for the radio quiet, radio loud distinction. Here's the since the VLA was invented, it was possible to make maps of these things, and then the first diagram of the histogram of the number versus delta looked like this. So if the jets came along out along the disk axis, delta would be 90 degrees, right? And what's seen is this sort of broad distribution. It looks a bit funny, as there seems to be a hole here and a hole here, but the small numbers are involved. But at least you can say from this that the jets are not coming out along the axis of the stellar disk, right? There's no trend for them to be along the minor axis of the disk. Continuing this historical approach, Schmidt et al. Recently looked at this with more data. What they found was rather similar, in that there seems to be an absence of objects here, but again, notice a very small number of objects.
And they were able to split the data into Seaford 2s and Seaford 1s, and they found that this hole here, this hole here, which is in their data almost entirely due to the Seaford 1s. So the Seaford 1s seem to have an absence of objects at small delta, and the Seaford 2s seem to, and also at large delta, and the Seaford 2 is perhaps an absence of objects at large delta. And they interpreted this work, this in terms of a trend for, they suggested that from this data there's a trend for nuclear axes to be in Seaford 1 to be preferentially close to the galaxy disk axis. Now the three-dimensional axis between the actual axis in three dimensions between the axis of the accretion disk and the axis of the stellar disk is going to be called beta. And so they were suggesting that Seaford 1s are preferring to have their axes preferentially close to the axis of the galaxy disk, whereas Seaford 2s can have almost any beta. But they also noticed that there seems to be this strange absence of for both Seaford 1s and Seaford 2s at large delta. Right. Next people to come along are Clark, Kinney, and Pringle. And they did something that sort of paper that should have been done a long time ago. That's supposed to be a compliment. They discussed how to best use the observables, which are delta and the inclination of the stellar disk, to estimate what we're interested in, which is beta, the angle which is the angle between the accretion disk axis and the stellar disk axis. So geometry looks like this. Here's the plane of the galaxy stellar disk. We're observing from a direction like this. Everything you talk about in this semester is singularity of the origin here, of course. Here's the rotation axis of the galaxy disk. Here's the jet axis at some arbitrary angle, inclined beta from the galaxy axis, inclined phi from the line of sight. The projection of the jet axis into the plane of the sky, plane like this, is at delta from the major axis of the stellar disk. And this azimuthal angle around here is called theta. So the question is, how do you attempt to find beta given that you know delta and I? Of course, there is no unique solution for any one object because all you have is a projected direction of the jet, so the jet can lie at any location on the great circle, which includes the true jet axis and the line of sight. So the great circle on this unit sphere along which the jet can lie. But of course there's a minimum value of beta, which is where this great circle passes closest to the galaxy axis, and that they refer to as beta min. So one can at least from delta and I calculate beta min, and they did that, and this is what they got. And they did it for Seaford 1 and Seaford 2s, and again what they found was similar to what was found by Schmidt et al, that the Seaford 1s seem to prefer lower betas. See, the Seaford 1s tend to prefer lower beta mins, but this effect is barely significant statistically. You can see the data is limited because what's being plotted is a cumulative distribution. So it's a sign that the observers are having trouble with having enough data when you see a diagram like that. They also devised another method for estimating p beta, which is sort of a consistency method. You begin by assuming a certain probability for beta, which if it were random, which is the most natural thing to assume, would be equal to sine beta. And then given this, you can calculate what p phi to phi plus d phi is in terms of beta and sine phi. And then you take each data point, which is a delta, each observation gives you a delta and an I, and you distribute this over the unit sphere according to this weighting in given by this assumption here. So this is a weighting function that is used to distribute each data point. And then you have a distribution on the sphere, in all of the sphere, and what you would then do is integrate over this azimuthal angle theta to get back an estimate, another estimate of P beta, which is called P out. Then you compare P in beta and P out beta and see whether they're consistent. And when they did this, the P out, keep that on that red one, P out, they're now looking like that. And this is plotted in a form such that if the jets were completely random, you would have a straight line, and there's a straight line. The data are obviously consistent with the jets being completely random in this approach. Okay. You can also try to look at the Seifert 1 and the Seifert 2 separately, as they did, and the way that they did this was to assume the strong unified scheme applies to Seifert 1 and Seifert 2, which would mean that Seifert 1 and Seifert 2 were only distinguished by the angle phi. For Seifert 1, you're looking down the pole of the jet. The jet is supposed to be aligned with the axis of the obscuring torus. So Seifert 1s are objects with phi less than some value, call it phi c, and Seifert 2s are objects in which phi is greater than some value. And if you assume that, that's a strong unified scheme. You can then try to see whether by playing with phi c, whether there's a difference between the ones and the twos. And they found that what they did was to look at the perspective they took was to try to see whether there's choose the value of phi c, which makes the minimum difference between the distribution of beta for ones and twos. And this is what they got. And again, they seem to get a suggestion that the Seifert ones tend to prefer small betas, and have something of an absence of 10 to the absence of large betas. And this was significant at the 96% significance level. And they concluded that Seifert ones, the accretion distance Seifert ones, tend to align with the galaxy stellar disk. Whereas in Seifert 2 it's more or less random. Now, I think this conclusion is incorrect, and
we described the differences that degree of certainty, where it could be because different properties.
It is strange, yes. Yes, I don't see any. Yes.
Yeah, the other way around. If it happens, it's not aligned.
That
might be the sense.
Well, after we'd done this survey with the BLA, we decided to look at this again. And so Neil Nagar is a graduate student at Maryland. And we tried to look very critically at the data here. For example, the radio, a nice radio axis can be gotten if you have a nice jet, right? But if you only have a slightly resolved source, which is the case in much of these objects, then you wouldn't believe the axis of being the axis of the jet quite as much. Galaxy disk axes are best determined from kinematics, and there are about a dozen Seifert galaxies with kinematic axes. Other good axes are, of course, when the galaxy is highly inclined, then you're pretty sure that you get the major axis reliable. When the galaxy is more or less face on, you have trouble with photometric axes from bars and oval distortion and things like that. So we tried to give each point a reliability index based on these considerations. and these are the distribution of delta that we got. C for 1 is 0.0 to 1.5, 1.8, 1.9, 2.0, and the whole lot together. So this is just a number versus the projected angle delta. Right. Now what's and the dark object, the dark squares are the most reliable and the white squares are the least reliable. What seems to have happened is that the hole in the small values of delta that Schmidt et al. Had in their sample seems to be becoming filled in to a certain extent. And if you look at all of them, well, they're obviously well spread over delta, but the first order, zeroth order of interpretation really is that there's probably no trend with delta. Certainly there's no significant difference between the ones and the twos as a function of delta. And I'll come back to this, to the secret twos by themselves in a moment. So we repeated the Clark et al. Processes. We followed their methods. So the observation data suggests that the hole in the sequence ones is now filled in, and distribution of delta for sequence ones and twos is not significant. Find the look at the distribution of p as a function of beta min, and what comes out is something that looks, however, much like what they found. That the sequence ones to 1.5s are trying to have small beta mins, and the sequence twos are trying to have large beta mins. But we don't think this is a consequence of a true difference in the distribution of the angle beta between the two, and for the following reason. If you look at the inclination distributions in the sample for the ones and the twos, what you see is there's a big absence of secret ones at large inclination. And this is almost certainly due to obscuration of the galaxy disk in the surveys that search for the secret ones. If you have a secret one at large inclination and you believe the unified scheme, then inevitably that galaxy has a large beta. Right? If you have a secret one which is being viewed almost edge on and its polar direction, and being a secret one, its axis has to be almost towards you, then it must have a large beta. So there's a selection effect here in that the absence of large inclination secret ones translates into an absence of large beta secret ones when you do the analysis. And we think that this is what's going on here. If instead we take just the galaxies with less than 60 degrees inclination, where the distribution is more or less the same, then we get the right panel, which has no difference between the ones and the twos. Again, we repeated their analysis for P beta, assuming a strong unified scheme for ones and twos, and this is then ended up as a function of the critical angle phi c, 30 degrees, 40 degrees, 50 degrees. And we get something which is very similar to what they got. These points again show this apparent excess of small beta for the secret ones. The horizontal lines here are not a fit to the data, but they are a model, the results of the model, which has the secret ones having a completely random distribution of accretion disks, but with the observed distribution of inclinations factored in. And you can see that this absence of high inclination secret ones by selection of the sample translates into this drop in the apparent number of secret ones as a function of beta. So basically the bottom line, what we think, and this is different from the conclusions of the two earlier papers, is that everything is to zero order consistent with a completely random distribution for the secret ones and the secret twos between the accretion disk axis and the galaxy stellar axis. There is, if we go back to this diagram, so that's the basic zeroth order result, that the distribution is random for both secret twos and secret ones as far as the data that we have at present are concerned. If you go back and look at the secret twos by themselves, there's a 90% confidence trend for there to be a decline as you go to large beta in this diagram. So as you're now looking at the second order thing that is present at only the 90% significance level, it cannot be a zone of avoidance at small beta simply because of the projection effects. When you're looking at, of course, when you're looking at this, when you make your observations, if you see a galaxy projected, an absence of galaxy projected at large delta, that is an absence of galaxies projected with a radio axis projected along the galaxy minor axis, then it's hard to make a big hole here by taking away the galaxies with beta near zero, right? Simply because because of the projection effect. It's all simple geometry. The galaxy, if you just ask what the distribution as a function of beta and theta is for galaxies with large delta, then it looks something like this, with delta greater than 70 degrees. So this region where there appears to be a hole in the delta distribution translates back to this distribution as a function of beta and theta. And you need to have a big hole at delta greater than 70 degrees, you need to have a big hole at theta equals 90 degrees. But this is just the angle of view selected by the observations, right? So you'd have to have you'd have to be viewing these things in a special way, which we obviously are not. So we don't think that there's an absence of objects at small beta causing this hole, this possible hole at delta. More likely, it seems that if this effect is real, there's just a general trend for the number to decline somewhat with delta. And this dotted line is actually a model in which a random distribution has been taken, and the number of objects with small beta, which tends to come out down here, has been reduced by 50%. Number of objects with large beta has been increased by 50%. And if this effect is real, which the safe and only a 90% significance level effect, then there are various explanations. Could be there's actually less gas along the polar axis, so that if the radio emission is made by the interaction of a jet with the surrounding gas somehow, then you might get less galaxies, when you might see less galaxies with radio emission sticking out of the galaxy disk. There's also a contamination of the radio emission by galaxy disk emission, which would tend to be interpreted as beta equals 90 ejector. This is actually my favorite interpretation of this effect. Or it could be something more exotic. You'd have heavy blobs representing the radio emission coming up and then being bent down towards the galaxy disk and to avoid the polar axis. Or it could be a real trend for the accretion disk to actually avoid close alignment with the stellar disk. But I've not been able to think of any way in which that effect could occur. One can imagine a random distribution, but actually avoiding the planes of stellar disk seems to be hard to imagine. So basically the zeroth order thing is that the accretion disks are essentially randomly oriented with respect to the stellar disk. One last thing in this in this topic, is that if you plot out delta, which is the radio axis minus the major axis of the galaxy, as a function of morphological type of the galaxy, this is the Hubble stage of the galaxy, translating to more familiar Hubble types up here. What you see from this diagram is, of course, that super galaxies like to occur in early type spiral galaxies, perhaps because the mass of the black holes are bigger there, but there are some SB and SC. But what's interesting is the suggestion of a hole in the data, a hole of points in this bottom right quadrant. And again, this is significant at the 96% level. So again, more data are always needed. I'll come back and say what I think that may be telling us in a moment. Related to this is the fact that in at least some early type objects, the axis of the outflow is different for different ejections. So here are maps of a secret galaxy. On this scale, which is hard for me to read to see, is about 2 parsecs, I think about 100 parsecs. On this kind of scale, the axis is north-south, and on a much smaller scale, the more recent ejector is at a quite different angle. And there are cases of early-type sequence where that's seen. Here's an exceptionally good case, Markarian 6, where you look at the very smallest scales, 300 parsec, the jet is north-south. You look at intermediate scales, it's east-west, and then you look at larger scales, it's something like that. So there are simply three different sequential ejections with different orientations. So what I think is more consistent with what we see in all of this is that to zeroth order, the axes are randomly oriented, and most of the galaxies are early type galaxies, S0s and SAs. Most likely the gas is of external origin and has been accreted from some kind of interaction with the gas-rich galaxy, and the gas disk in the center has settled down into some random orientation. But the suggestion that in the late type galaxies the jets are pointing out of the disk suggests that in the late type galaxies the accretion disk is getting its gas from the internal sources in the disk. That is, the gas could be of internal origin, and this is why there's this 96% significant effect for the accretion disk to align with the galaxy stellar disk. So it's all sort of fitting with what you more or less think, and then in these cases where the accretion disk is flopping about, maybe it's due to accretion of different clouds, maybe there's a whole range of planes of the gas coming in, or maybe it's some kind of instability, like Pringle's radius degree instability that's driving the disk around.
But can you say anything about the time scale for the random reorientation?
Yes. You're talking about the time scales for these things are the largest scale structure, the 100 parsec scale structure, is of the order of 10 to the 6 years. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing things changing on that on a time scale of, let's say, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 years, something like that.
Yes.
I would say. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of time scale you'd be talking about for this, the change like that.
Sounds uncomfortably short for random flybys.
You have to have different, somehow the galaxy would have to be really shredded and be coming in different clouds coming in different directions. So maybe, yeah, that's
quite striking actually.
It's quite striking, yes.
Is there any possibility, Andrew, and this is maybe a question revealing my ignorance here,
that you actually, that the large scale fractures that you're seeing, the kiloparsec scale fractures, are not really jets, but they're super winds that are massive outputs in the galaxy caused by Cerber's activity. Or you think that?
Well, this is of course the old question, when you see things like this, things like this are not made by. This is the
right.
This is the characteristic structure that you see when you get enough resolution on these objects.
I agree, but I'm talking about the large scale structure.
Well, this is the large scale structure. This is a kiloparsec. This is the whole length of the source in this galaxy.
Okay, but I'm comparing. Okay. The structure on the right hand side, the truly extended structure that you're seeing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, there's always a possibility that something like this could represent a super wind or something like that. I guess that it's a possibility.
But
in this case, you've got three axes, you know, so it's not just an accretion disk, a stellar disk. Two won't do. In this case, there really seems to be three cases. But in most cases, all we have is something on the kiloparsec scale, right? And when you map that, there's only relatively few of these cases where you have this flopping effect known. But even on a kiloparsec scale, when you get good maps, they really are well collimated. So that's the first part of the response.
So yes. This is possessing and this walking possessing. The part is good, right?
Yes.
The part of precession of the world from the fact rather, you know. And there's so much uncertainty in the parameter that it could be right.
Yes. It depends where you think the radio emission is coming from, what scale it is. Where it's coming from, if you grab a check for radio, and I think these times are too long.
Yeah, but
right. You have to be somewhere out in the disk.
It's
not
coming
from
the wind or something.
Yeah. Yeah, if it's coming from further out of the disk, then the precession time scales may be okay. 10-4, 10-5 years. Okay, let me go on to the second part of the talk.
These are normally relativistic.
Ah, well, yes.
No, but probably they don't count out.
I think they are, yes.
Oh, they are?
Yeah, I think they are non-relativistic.
Oh, they are non-relativistic.
I think that's what it's all about, actually. Let's come at this business of the radio, quiet radio lounge dichotomy from an observational direction. Talk about what's actually going on with these ejectors we've been talking about with respect to the gas in the gas disk, in the disk of the galaxy. With Pierre Ferrari, who was a postdoc with me at Mellon, and Hannah Parker, who was a postdoc with me at Mellon, we've been doing some projects looking closely at the inner regions of these galaxies with HST, where mostly imaging in emission lines, with an integral field spectra on the CFHT, which gives you a three-dimensional coverage of the emission lines, almost any emission lines you want. It gives you velocity fields and line ratios over the narrow line region. One thing that Ferrari has developed is a deconvolution of these data, in which when you have the HST image of the an emission line, you have an image of, say, 50 milliarc seconds resolution. From the ground, you have this three-dimensional spatial times velocity coverage, but at a lower resolution. But you know that when you add over all velocities, then the image should be the same as the HST image. So this is a constraint that can be built into a deconvolution sequence that Ferrari has developed based on advice without help from Leon Lucy, as to how you can deconvolve these three-dimensional data using the HST image as a constraint. And that's how we've been improving the resolution of these data. And in fact, we think you can get down to about 0.3 arc seconds resolution in these CFHT three-dimensional data cubes. And of course, there's the VLA, which gives you sort of 10 arc second resolution. I'm going to talk about one object which I think illustrates what's going on very clearly. The Mach 573 is a CP2 galaxy. This is an image in H alpha and N2, and the contours of the radio, or the central radio component,
There's another way your component up here. This is rather high resolution map. It doesn't look as significant as it really is, but really is a very good way your component there. And there's another one down there. So you have this one, two, three. You have this triple radio source. Then you have this arc around here of gas of 10 to 4 degrees. There's an arc around there, sort of, with the radio components on its edge here. And then there are actually a couple of arcs further out. So even from the, just looking at that picture, you would believe there's a strong interaction going on between the radio ejector jet and the gas in the disk of the galaxy. And this is confirmed by the kinematic data. I'll show you. It's a bit of a vast amount of data you can get from this system. So here again is the radio map as the contours superposed on the HST image, and the radio map superposed on the deconvolved Tiger image using this constraint that the image has to match the HST image's full resolution.
Can you use that constraint, Andy? What would the resolution be?
Resolution without any deconvolved. Well, the resolution, the raw resolution is about 0.8, 0.9. And then you can do, if you have a star, which there is, I think, which was observed separately actually, you can also do a standard Lucy deconvolution, with get a point space function from a star, and that, I think, improved down about 0.6, and then you incorporating the HST image brought it down to about 0.3. The theory of this is not really very well worked out, whether how unique the deconvolution is at the end. The velocity of light, I don't want to worry about deconvolution, but anyway, we think we've done lots of tests and it's pretty robust. You get the same velocity field in different emission lines. Well, anyway, here's the velocity field, right? And what you see is that this very blue emission here, which coincides precisely with this radio component. And there's some red emission out here, which seems to more or less follow the axis of the radio jet to the southeast. And then further out, the gas moves into normal rotation in the gas disk. So, what you also see, again, skipping all the details here, what you also see is that the line widths at the locations of radio components are very wide. Right, so this now shows you the line widths, the line profiles. What we were talking before about was the centroid velocity of the line. So where you see this very blue shifted line, it's also very broad. And this coincides with the northwest radio components. The arcs themselves are actually rather narrow. Up down here, but down where the radio component is in this location, again you find a broader line. We're talking about widths of order 500 kilometers per second here, and of order less than or over 200 kilometers per second in the arcs and further out. So there's no doubt that what's happening is that the radio ejector is dumping their energy into the narrow line region, and this has been suspected for a long time, and we see this in more detail as we get better data. And just to convince you of this is reliable, here's the same thing done for completely different emission lines, H alpha and N2, and you can see the basic velocity field is just the same. Strong blue spot here where the west radio component is, and with a very good agreement between the different lines.
What is the frame in the sort of ellipse? Is that a pure artifact?
What, this thing here?
Yes.
I think what's being seen here is the you can only measure the velocity where there's line emission. There are these outer rings, these arcs,
yes,
which I showed you on the earlier. So there's the inner arc, which is in here, and the outer arc. Okay, so I think that's probably what you're seeing.
Yeah, but there's a real features in imaging.
Yeah, I think obviously they're real.
Does it envelop the whole source?
Well, you can't, there isn't much line emission down here, so you can't see whether there's actually a ring structure here or not. You just see this arc up here and arc down there. So we don't know whether it engulfs the whole source. Yeah, either it's a ring that existed in the external galaxy, or it's maybe an old shock driven out into the interstellar gas by an early ejector. Ejection.
Is the radio emission on much larger scale than you portrayed?
No, there is not. There is no more radio emission in, I'm showing you.
So that could be a bounding shock of the whole radio thing.
I think these inner things are bounding shocks. Yes, I think these little arcs here are radiative bow shocks which have been driven into the ISM by the radio source. So you have a high velocity gas in here where the radio ejector are. There will be some slower shocks being driven out, and maybe the rings which you were talking about are this thing and this thing, and maybe it's an old ejection or something. We don't know.
Could it be projection of the processing jet?
What? This?
Yeah.
I haven't thought about that. In line emission, right? I haven't thought about that. There's not much radio. There's barely radio emission out here. There may be a bit of weak radio emission out here, but not down here. So I suspect not. Okay. So with all this data, you can do some interesting things. And one thing you can do is to measure the run of the density from the sulfur doublet. All this has been done for both sulfur lines, so we have complete coverage of the density of the gas. And you can also estimate the ionization parameter from line ratios. And this is shown in here. This is actually a map of the ionization parameter, and then a plot of the function of radius of the ionization parameter measured from different lines. And those of you familiar with photo ionization models will know that once you have the radius from the central source, you have the ionization parameter, and you have the gas density, then you can calculate the number of ionizing photons from the supposed central point source. And you can do that for each point in the nebulosity. So everywhere in the nebulosity, you can calculate what Q ion should be. And what you find is this graph down here, which shows that Q ion as a function of the location where you calculate it using the density and the ionization parameter. And for a point source in the central, this should of course be a straight line. But it isn't. The number of ions in front appears to increase as you go to larger radii. You could probably ignore this bit in the center, which is shaded because of ceiling effects, but we believe this increase towards larger radii is real, and if it's real, then you don't have a point source of ionizing photons. You have something making ionizing photons sort of on the scale of the radio sources, on the scale of the high velocity gas in this galaxy. So what this then brings up is the question of what is ionizing the narrow line region in these active galaxies. And the two possibilities: either it's a point source in the center, which might be the accretion disk. Anybody who heard Ski's talk at the meeting here in February will realize there are all sorts of questions about whether the accretion disk is really the ionizing source. Or, as suggested by this data, it might be some kind of extended source associated with a mass outflow. And the way this works is through driving high velocity shocks into the surrounding gas, and this process can the shock velocity can range above 200 kilometers a second, say anywhere 200 to 1,000 kilometers a second, can create a substantial amount of ionizing radiation. And this has been, of course, known for a long time. Greg Shields has known about it for a very long time, and recently been emphasized by the Australian group. What happens is that you drive the shockwave into the surrounding gas, you get hot gas behind the shock wave, which radiates ionizing radiation, which then propagates downstream and upstream. Upstream it gives you a precursor of gas, which is just photo ionized gas, the temperature about 10 to 4 degrees. And given the kind of spectrum radiated by these shocks, it turns out that the spectra of these precursors can look very similar to the emission line spectra of secret galaxies, of active galaxies. Here's an example of this phenomenon in real life. This is a supernova remnant. Here's the X-rays in contours, which show you where the hot gas is behind some kind of shock. And here's O3, high excitation optical line emission, ahead of the shock, which is postulated to be just this precursor. Gas ahead of the shock being ionized by the hot gas, the EUV emission and soft X-rays from the shock. And the observational spectra of, I'm going to show you the spectra of this region, of this O3 emission, which is the upper spectrum. Alright, that's this outer rim. And a spectrum of a supergalaxy, off the nuclear region of a supergalaxy. And you see the line ratios are really very similar. So you're getting 2.68 in both galaxies, like a high O3 temperature, and so forth. So this process of outflow of the shocking can give you something which looks very similar to the Seeker 2 spectrum. And the question is that what's happening? Is there really insignificant ionizing radiation from the central source, and what we're dealing with completely is a mass outflow which powers the whole thing?
Interestingly now, the X-ray spectra also similar between different kinds of objects.
Right, okay. It means the shock velocity must be similar. So it's the kind of thing which kind of picture which is used, is considered.
On the order of 1 AU gamma, when you look at these and you see the physicists who take galaxies. But anyway.
So there's a high velocity jet then in this picture. It creates a bow shock. The bow shock creates the radiation which ionizes the gas. So this is the picture. You might.
If you've got that high velocity jet, there are only two shocks there.
There's an internal shock, yes.
There's going to be an internal shock, and presumably contact this continuity surrounds. Separating it from
that's what the solid line is supposed to be, yeah. I think.
And then an external bow shock.
That's right. The dotted line, here's the dotted line at the bow shock, and then the internal shock is not drawn in this particular diagram.
But how can you rule out that much of the emission comes from internal shocks, or, for example, clouds that have got into the jet?
You can't in detail. What's suggested by, for example, this particular galaxy that I showed you is that a lot of the emission is outside of the radio, is beyond the radio source.
Yeah.
In this case, one of the two cases,
you're really studying these. It really look like a bounding bow shock surrounding
it. It might be, yes, but certainly there's no radio emission outside the radio emission I showed you. There's no detected radio emission outside the region I showed you. So most of the line emission in that picture of it is coming from further out. But from a conceptual standpoint, yes, maybe there's mixing and things like that along the edges here. And of course, we do see line emission projected onto the end of the jet. Yeah. In this case, that's where the velocity was very high. So there is some gas getting in here and mixing in.
Especially extending around the gas maybe safely, but the jet may be even faster.
Yes, all that's certainly possible. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sure he'll come off the gamma ray.
You might wonder whether these arcs, which I showed you, are actually photoionizing shocks. The answer in this particular case is no. I don't have time to go into it. We think that if the ejection is actually causing the ejection is actually responsible for the ionizing photons, it probably is more of what Roger was saying, that it's gas which has got in here rather than the actual bow shock in this particular case. That the high velocity gas is seen in associated with the radial components, presumably the end of the jet. And it may be that non-radiative shocks in this region are responsible for the ionizing photons. You can actually show rigorously that those arcs at the end of the jet are not photoionizing shocks, but I can talk about it if somebody's interested.
How high velocity?
Right. Well, I think in the inner parts of these things, they're almost certain. The one out here, I think, is almost certainly like we're going to be radiative.
What things can they do?
Well, out here, the line width is just 200 kilometers per second. And that, it's...
high density is longer time scale, but
the high densities would make the time scale shorter. Yes. I think that arc is a shock. I think it is a cool bow shock, cool region behind a bow shock, but for the reason which I'm not going to spend the time going into, we think it's externally illuminated. Not illuminated by itself, but illuminated by perhaps by the faster gas associated with the jet itself in this region, as you were saying. Okay, another approach to this is that if you do have shocks of velocities of order 520 a second, there must be soft X-rays coming from them. And the question then you can ask is there the amount of soft X-rays you expect from these galaxies? Well, the problem is that you don't have the spatial resolution to really separate off this region from the larger scale part of the galaxy and the nucleus. But the steeper twos, there's such a huge column to the nucleus. For the nucleus itself, the average column is of the order of 3 times 10 to the 23 to the actual nucleus. So the nucleus source, if you've seen steeper ones, is completely blotted out in soft X-rays. And you can still show that there is an excessive X-ray emission in these galaxies compared to a normal galaxy. So the most natural place for this soft X-ray emission in steeper twos to come from is the narrow line region. So the question is the amount of X-rays that you see compatible with the amount of O3 that you're getting? So with John Raymond, we recently looked at this and we calculated the X-ray flux using his code, and we calculated the O3 flux using the calculations of Doppler and Sutherland. And the nice thing about comparing this X-ray flux with the O3 flux is that the thing you don't know, which are the density, pre-shock density, the magnetic field, and the area of the shock, don't matter when you just take the ratio of the X-rays to the O3. Because the X-ray emission and the O3 emission depend in the same way on the density cancels out in this ratio. And the area of the shock is the same. And the magnetic field, which affects the compression you get downstream, is important for the hot post-shock gas, immediate post-shock gas behind the shock, or the O3, which is mostly supposed to come from the precursor. So for a given shock velocity in a given abundance, you get a unique ratio between a Rosse count rate, or an X-ray flux, like, and an O3 flux. And these are the lines. These lines show that ratio for different shock velocities. Here's 300, here's 500, here's 1,000. And here are the data points. You see there's quite a few upper limits, but seem to be compatible with a shock of velocity around about 500, 400 kilometers a second. We did the same thing for the Einstein database. And this is, we've got something fairly similar. Again, shocks perhaps at around 450 on average most compatible with the data. So there is soft X-ray emission there. There is a soft X-ray emission there that you expect from this kind of picture. Now, of course, the soft X-rays could be coming across some other process, but at least the data is compatible with that. With AXAP, we'll be able to get in and look with high resolution to make sure and see exactly where the X-ray emission is coming from, whether it's coming from these narrow line regions, these soft regions. All right, now what has all this got to do with radio loud, radio quiet, and radio loud objects? Most of you are familiar with this, with these definitions. The place where the radio loud, radio quiet dichotomy shows up most clearly is in this diagram, which involves two things we've been talking about: the radio emission plotted on the left and the line emission plotted horizontally. So because these objects more or less have all the same spectral index, this is essentially the radial proportion of the radial luminosity. And because they have almost all the same ratio of emission lines, this is proportion of the ionizing luminosity. We know these lines are photo ionized. The question is where the photons are coming from. Are they coming from the shock, as I've been talking about, or is it decreasing it? So this is proportion of the ionizing luminosity. And this is really a very strange diagram, right? And you might expect a wide range of objects in this diagram, but what's very strange is that they're split up into two groups, right? That's really bizarre, right? There's a hole in the middle where objects don't likely exist. I don't believe this is any kind of selection effect of the data. I think it's a real hole. And so the things up here, which are FR1 radio galaxies, FR2 radio galaxies, radio loud quasars, of this sequence here, they're called radio loud, and super galaxies, super ones, super twos, radio quiet quasars follow this sequence up here. They're just points which are intermediate between them.
Well,
the two. No, there's no other significance. He just dotted them black.
Okay.
Yeah, just forget about the dotting. Notice that there's a factor of if you draw a line through this and a line through this, there's a factor of 3,000 between these two, and that's important. And I'll come back to that in a minute. So here's sort of summarizing some of the properties. You all know that really they look very much the same in the infrared to X-ray band, similar spectral shapes to infrared to X-ray, similar emission line spectra, but the radio emission, the radio loud, is 3,000 times more luminous than the radio quiet at a given ionizing luminosity. Okay, now how does this arise? Well, we've got a very nice clue from some recent work with the VLBA. You all know that radio astronomers have been mapping out compact radio sources with VLBI for many years. What they tend to find is superluminal motion of compact radio sources. For the weaker sources, we've had to wait for like supergalaxies, radio quiet quasars, we've had to wait for the VLBA to be able to do this. But what's beginning now are programs to monitor the velocity of the components in the radio quiet components, radio quiet objects. This has now been done for three objects, which have nice compact radio sources, and a nuclear radio source, which actually varied between these two epochs. These are maps of the same radio source at two different times, and one can measure the relative speed of these two sources, and the answer is that the apparent velocity of expansion in this object, the super 2, is 0.07c. So it's also been done for Marconi 231, where the answer is about the same, 0.1c or thereabouts, and for 4151, where there are upper limits of about 0.2c. And all this data is going to get better very quickly as the monitoring continues. So all the three radio quiet ones that have been looked at have apparently non-relativistic outflows. There's always a question of what you're looking at here, whether you're looking at the true jet speed or some kind of wave in the jet or something, compression in the jet that's not moving in true jet speed. But still, it's different to what you find in most radio louds. And it's not...
I mean, MAD7 is sort of a cautionary tale.
where you get 0.36 on the small scale and allegedly 16 in the knot.
16 they're claiming for the I agree, it's not a completely Centaur is another one. So, but still, I would say that if you look at the database as a whole, and you just pick out a random three objects, the chances are that all three would be superluminal for these compact flat spectrum sources.
Right, the other test is what Langley does with the FR1, which is just the one sided. I think it's a big number in a different way that you can do that. And there, from the sort of axis ratio, he argues that the FR1s, although they look non relativistic on the VLA scale, start off right from the system.
Yes.
Could that still be true here?
Well, you're getting very close in now. Right.
Yeah.
It's been clear that on the VLA, on the particle scale, they're not relativistic. There's not the asymmetries. Right. Now it's gone down to 0.5 parsecs. So this is getting very close in. It's not down to gravitational radio or anything, but it's a leap forward by a factor of 100 or so.
I don't know what the spectra are of those.
The nuclear source is a flat spectrum self-absorbed synchrotron source.
Both one-sided, I guess.
These are the same source mapped at two different times. So it's just one source mapped at two different times. We just see something on one side. That's true. But
you haven't got a larger set of objects that have just been imaged once rather than monitored.
Well, remember the picture I showed you of NGC 4151, which is a VLBA image, that's two-sided. Two-sided all its length, really. Right. 4258 is also two-sided. The problem with this is we don't know where the nucleus is. Really, we don't know where to put the nucleus. But anyway, let me assume that what I think your data is telling us is that these very quiet ones are likely to have non-relativistic ejecta. Now, okay. So let me remind you then that these non-relativistic ejecta are dumping all their energy in the narrow line region on these kiloparsec scales, and they may fully power the narrow line region. Now, if they fully power the narrow line region, you can estimate what the power rate that's being supplied by the jet actually is. And you can do that very easily by comparing the radio with the emission line luminosity. So here's a plot of the observed ratio, just of the radial luminosity of the emission lines. And you can see that the average is about, the average radio power is about a thousandth of the emission in the emission lines. And then you make these emission lines through the shock model that I've talked about. You have to multiply the power in the emission lines by about a factor of 3 to get the total kinetic power in the shock. So in other words, the ratio of radio power to the total power in the jet is, in this model, in this interpretation of the emission lines as jet-driven shocks, 2,000.